direct alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war.
Good morning, Montreal. You are tuned to the Wednesday Morning After on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We have a good show for you today with three podcasts. In the first hour, we'll visit In the Shower with Taz and Marcus, where the question is, why do sandwiches taste better when cut diagonally? Then we'll join Rabble to explore the question, why are abortions still an election issue? 8 o'clock brings Democracy Now!, 8:15 brings weather, and at 8:30 we'll have a treat from India. The Eat This podcast shares the delicate flavor of buttered chicken. After some music, we'll wrap up the show. Let's start the day off with some music.
You're listening to Radio CKUT 90.3 FM Montreal or online at ckut.ca.
This is a dilemma that has been stalking delis and languishing in lunchboxes for hundreds of years. This week on In the Share, we ask, why do sandwiches taste better, if they taste better, when they're cut diagonally?
In the shower with Taz and Marcus, 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 in the shower with Taz and Marcus.
Hello, lovely listener, and welcome to In the Shower with Taz and Marcus, a bite-sized, informative podcast that's aimed to be listened to while you're in the shower, but really, you can listen to it anywhere at all.
The whole point of this podcast is that you, the listener, the user, the person on the other end of this voice, send in a question that has kept them awake at night forever, and we do our best to answer it in the time it takes you to have a shower.
Have you ever wondered why we kiss?
Or why some people have a dominant hand?
Or why we laugh?
Or what is actually happening when you have an itch?
Well, good news, you've come to the right spot. We have answered all of those questions and many, many, many more on our podcast, and we're about to tackle one more.
Step into the share with us as we tackle another question.
This week's episode of In the Share with Taz and Marcus asks, why do sandwiches taste better when they're cut diagonally?
In the shower with Taz and Marcus, 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 in the shower with Taz and Marcus.
Right, so listen, before we get into this episode properly, I have to say it.
What?
Like, I just have to put this out there, that this is absolutely, unequivocally, undoubtedly, certainly, 100% my favourite type of question to answer on this podcast.
What do you mean by that?
So, you know, occasionally we get questions that are very open and shut. Like, you know, what's an itch? Like, that's it's a nervous response that evolved from whatever. Like, you know, there's some questions that have, like, real scientific research and, like, a well-established, like, it's not a hypothesis anymore. Like, it's just, it's open and shut. And then occasionally you get questions like this one, that surprised us a little bit.
The amazing thing about the world and about people and about the internet is that someone has always looked into everything.
Exactly. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter if it's like how much wood a woodchuck would chuck or why we put up Christmas trees or anything like that or sandwich cutting techniques. I guarantee you that somebody somewhere in some far-flung corner of the world has probably done a PhD on whatever you're wondering about.
So you're actually telling me you found information on why a sandwich tastes better when it's cut diagonally?
Yeah, so listener, in case you're wondering how this kind of works in the podcast, that people send us in questions, and we have a big Google Drive document, basically, with all of the questions that we receive. And some of them are terrible, some of them are great. And then there's these ones that kind of occupy a middle ground as a question that you don't really know until you search for them. So when I read, like, why do sandwiches taste better when they're cut diagonally, first of all, it hit me, because it made me ask myself the question.
Jeez, you said that very intensely. First of all, it hit me.
Yeah, it
made me ask myself the question.
You know, it hit me at a very personal level, because I enjoy a sandwich. And
I've been known to enjoy a sandwich.
Listen, but who hasn't?
Do you know what? There's a type of sandwich in every culture, isn't there? It's like,
pretty much, you can have a kebab, you can have a taco, you can have a bao.
You can have a burrito, you can have a...
Exactly. It's just, but like, when you think about what a sandwich is, it's just like, you know, it's convenient. It's whatever, some kind of vessel containing a filling.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's like...
Actually, wasn't there a man called with the second name Sandwich?
Yeah, we'll get to that later in the episode.
Oh, brilliant.
We'll
I can't wait.
We'll get to that later in the episode. But when I read that episode or read the question and I actually looked into it, I did that initial kind of Google search, lots of people had asked the same question. So I figured, let's answer this on In the Shower. Let's figure out why sandwiches taste better, and they do taste better when they're cut diagonally.
Okay, please inform me. Let's get crusty.
Okay, are you ready? Shall we begin?
Yes.
Okay. So let's establish that the two styles of sandwich cut that we are talking about are diagonal on the positive, on the better tasting side, and horizontal on the no thank you side, right?
Okay.
So that is to say, if you have one square sandwich, we're talking like standard sandwich loaf. I want everyone to envision that. I'm not talking like a baguette. I'm not talking about, you know, a granary loaf. I'm talking about just a standard
sliced pan loaf
of bread. Wonder Bread if you're in the States or Canada. Brennan's if you're in Ireland. Hovis if you're in the UK. You know, just like a standard loaf of bread, right?
Okay, you're getting very excited about this. You're like a kid in a sandwich store.
Okay, so like let's just say that the two style of cuts, one is diagonal and one is horizontal. So one square sandwich cut into two triangles is better than one square sandwich cut into two rectangles, right?
Okay.
With me so far?
Yes.
So to begin, let's talk about the actual structure and geometry of the sandwich.
Wow, we are talking about the geometry of a sandwich shower.
As imagined in a lunchbox or in a sandwich bag, specifically in the hours leading up to lunch.
Okay, I'm getting hungry now.
I know, it's almost lunchtime, so this is think about this as like, you know, food foreplay. So we're going to talk about support, because support is important. We all need a bit of support in our lives, right?
Okay.
A sambo cut into two rectangles, those are two very non-congruent shapes. They'll sag, they'll lose filling, and they'll just become unappealing. But do you know what?
What?
A sandwich cut into triangles sticks together, and it supports each other far, far, far better, making the sandwich more visually appealing when it comes to time to eat it.
Okay, right. So you're saying that structurally, when it's cut diagonally, it holds all the bits in better.
Yeah, so basically, like, listener, I want you to picture a square, right? Now, cut that square into two rectangles. All of a sudden, that's two shapes that don't really fit together in any way. Like, no matter how you put it, if you put one on top, it's going to squash the other one, and the filling from one is going to leak into the other. If you put them side by side, they're going to crumble like a building getting demolished, right? But two triangles sit on each other very nicely, and because they're load-bearing, they don't actually squash each other or actually transfer fillings too much, right?
Okay, I'm giving that first point a 4 out of 10. Not convinced yet. Next.
Okay, so listen, maybe I should have picked a better point to start on. Staying on a geometric theme, right? A sandwich, traditionally, has always been a vessel for the fillings. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree. Filling is key. Bread is also very important.
Bread is important, but I mean, like, a sandwich without a filling is just two slices of bread.
Yes,
yeah, so
yes,
I mean,
yes.
A sandwich cut along the diagonal offers a longer hypotenuse, thus maximizing tongue-to-sandwich filling contact, ergo facto maximizing the deliciousness experience contained therein.
Okay, I can't believe you're using bad legal jargon to explain sandwiches to me, but that is a better point. I will say the more of the filling that's on show, the more deliciousness your tongue is directly exposed to.
Yeah,
that is true.
You're getting about 30% more contact with the interior of the filling, right?
Okay. Okay. I'm on
so
board.
You're getting on board so far. Like, that's two strong points for the diagonal, right?
One extremely strong point, one mediocre point.
Now let's talk about convenience.
Okay,
sandwiches. Can you think of any other food type that is as good for, like, you know, a grab and go, other than like a banana or something?
Yeah,
like,
I would definitely have to agree with that. Like, there are very few foods that are perfectly conceived to be eaten on the hoof.
Right, and if something is grab and go, then let's talk about its grab zone, right?
Okay.
Think about it. Like, a triangular shape offers the most obvious place to grab while exposing the most sandwich to eat in a hurry, easily, on the run. When you think about it, the triangle, which is going like that, you can grab the point and you have the full sandwich exposed there, maximizing the variety of fillings that you can eat in one time and the amount of bites you can take. Whereas a square sandwich, you're just mashing it into your face like some kind of animal, you know?
Sandwich lawyer Marcus strikes again.
No, seriously, a rectangle cut offers no obvious grab zone and lessens the convenience of a deliberately convenient food, which, to be honest, is a borderline crime against humanity. Yeah, so listen.
Wow.
I know.
Okay, there are three valid points, I will say. Okay.
Right. Next.
There's more.
I am demolishing the case against rectangular sandwiches, right? Let's talk about a sandwich's best friend. Soup.
Oh, soup.
I know you're a big soup fan.
I love soup.
And it's coming into soup season. Let's talk about the soup dipping aspect of a sandwich for a second.
Okay.
Come here. Actually, what is your favorite soup and sambo combination?
Oh, how long do we have?
The time it takes someone to have a shower. Go.
Okay. Yeah. I really do like. I love a a good ham and cheese toasted with tomato, but that wouldn't be my favourite because that's not my favourite. Like, that would be kind of the go-to on the run, easy to have.
Yeah.
But I would prefer something like a really, really amazing soup that's kind of, that's interesting, that's different. And then the sandwich itself can be simpler, but my attention is on the soup.
But I mean, do you know what? Like, there's so many classic options that you can't really go far with. You're like, there's so many classic options that you can't go far wrong with when it comes to the sandwich and soup combination. Like, you know, grilled cheese and tomato.
Yum.
Is classic. Roast beef with French onion soup.
Yum.
Unbelievable. Or if you want to go like classic New York, you can have like a Reuben with matzo ball.
Oh, and what about a banh mi with a bowl of pho?
Oh, there you go. That's like, you know, bringing in Vietnamese. Do you know, that could be exceptionally good. But what we can agree on here is that sandwiches and soups are best friends, yeah?
If a sandwich could sing, it would pick up a bowl of soup and say, "You've got a friend in me. You've got a friend in me. If you got troubles, I've got them too. There isn't anything that I wouldn't do for you, Mr. Soup."
Have you ever tried to dunk a rectangle-cut sandwich in a bowl of soup?
I see where you're going here, and yes, that would be a total disaster.
The surface area of the corner of a rectangle sandwich is simply too much. Soup spills everywhere.
Oh, all over the table.
All over the dog.
The granny.
All over your laptop.
Oh, no.
All over everything. All over your bike, all over the floor. You know, it's just going to cause disruption in the family unit. It's just, it gets everywhere. A horizontally cut sandwich has no place being near soup. And tell me, do you want to keep two best friends apart?
You've got a friend in me.
Not anymore. Is that what you want? Seriously. No, cut your sandwich diagonally. I said sandwich. I'm a bit congested, listener.
Sandwich.
No, cut your sandwich diagonally and cast thine eyes upon the perfect dip you can achieve, regardless of the size, shape or volume of your soup container, because it has
A pointy tip. That is so fair. No, honestly, I think that is a very, very valid point. You need a tip to dump into the soup.
You need the tip to dump into the soup. And I mean, like, do you know what? If you're, with the diagonal cut, there's also, like, a couple of advantages to the tip. If you're not into the crust, you get so much more of the inside of the sandwich without actually having to eat the crust. If you get me? So, like, you get maximized bite area.
And because you can actually get into the corner as opposed to when you have a rectangle, if you don't want to eat the crust.
You kind of have to nibble.
Yeah.
But like if you're into the crust, it gives you four perfect initial bites. You can eat the six even. It's listen, what a time to be alive.
But wow.
I have one.
You've more.
I actually did practical research on.
Okay. I'm very excited.
And this is what I've dubbed the cheese bridge.
The cheese bridge?
Yeah, I did extensive research into this last night.
You did what?
Well, I say extensive research. I made two grilled cheese sandwiches. Which, do you know what? A grilled cheese is probably like my favourite go-to sandwich.
No, Marcus. Yeah. Of all the sandwiches.
It's perfect. Like,
I like the grilled cheese, but of all the sandwiches, first of all, you should never pick your favourite sandwich. That's like a mother picking its favourite child. I'm going to go back to the sandwich lords and tell them that you've picked a favourite.
Every parent has a favourite child, whether they say it or not.
Okay.
All right, but anyway, listen.
Go on,
Going back to my cheesy experiment. I made two grilled cheese sandwiches with identical weighed quantities of cheese, identical grill time and pan temperature, right? And I cut one diagonally and one horizontally and left them for 20 seconds each, right?
Okay.
The longer hypotenuse of the diagonally cut sandwich allowed for the creation of a longer, more impressive, more alluring cheese bridge. And since food tastes better when you actually look at it and want it, that is an actual determining factor to say that that is a tastier sandwich.
So. When you had a cheese sandwich, when you had a grilled cheese sandwich, it's essentially two slices of bread with cheese in the middle, when you toasted it, so the cheese melted, when you cut it across the diagonal, opposed to
Stretch was bigger on the diagonal.
So you got those stringy, cheesy bits, and were longer when you cut it diagonally.
Exactly. So, I mean, when you actually look it down, we have a longer hypotenuse, which is exposing you to more of the filling, giving you a more delicious bite experience.
Done.
Right?
I believe you.
That is serious. We have a better dunking area for soup or broth.
Absolutely.
Whatever you want to dunk it in, okay? You are the master of your own dunk. We have a better cheese bridge, which is very, very, very important.
And
right?
Structurally.
And then as well, we have a better support structure because triangles are sound. Right, they're a nice shape. Okay.
Wow.
There you go.
Okay, I did not think that you would be able to come to an answer for this episode, but...
Do you know what?
I will never cut
as soon,
a sandwich
as soon
across
as I started again. Writing this episode, I realised that there was never any doubt.
How much practical research did you do into this episode?
Two sandwiches, but this is going to become my life's work. Yeah.
I've started the thesis.
Yeah, it's going to be... It's going to be pretty impressive by the time I finish my PhD, which is going to be good.
What's the PhD going to be called?
The extent of diagonal cut sandwiches and their effect on Marx's waistline. Anyway, honestly, if you prefer horizontally cut sandwiches, maybe have a little look at yourself in the mirror and ask yourself what you're doing with your life.
And know that we love you regardless.
But not your sandwich techniques. Are you ready for some sandwich facts?
Yes.
So earlier...
First of all, I love that we're doing sandwich facts.
Yeah, listen, it has to be done. We end every episode with facts. And why wouldn't there be facts about a sandwich?
Okay, go on, hit me.
So you kind of alluded to this earlier. The sandwich was actually named after a Lord Sandwich.
Yes. Tell me more.
So Lord Sandwich was a serial gambler and hunter who didn't have time to eat because he was gambling so much.
Oh.
So he would ask his servants to bring him whatever his meal was, whatever it was, meat and everything like that, in between two slices of bread. And because he was a lord and influential and a member of the gentry, it actually became a thing. And people followed in his example and it just became known as a sandwich.
So you're telling me that occasionally good things come out of gambling?
Yeah, well, there you go. Sandwiches. Next time you have a sandwich, just remember that was born out of someone's horrible, like, crippling gambling addiction.
What I've taken from that more than anything is that there was somebody called Lord Sandwich.
I wonder, are his ancestors still alive?
Are the sandwiches?
Are still rocking around? The Earl of Sandwich.
No, I just love the family as a collective being called the Sandwiches. Gee, have you called the Sandwiches for Christmas dinner? Are the Sandwiches coming for Christmas dinner?
That'd be amazing. Oh, where do they live? A lunchbox. Yeah.
Okay, do you have any more facts?
I do. So the nation of Iran tried to get into the Guinness Book of World Records by making the world's largest sandwich.
Mm.
But they were disqualified.
Why?
Because people started eating the sandwich before it could be officially measured. So they failed.
Mm-hmm. Not going to lie, that would be very, very tempting. Because I'd say they were making that sandwich for a long time.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of it. It was big. It's a large sandwich.
So was it loads of different slices of bread, or was it like...
Like one long slice of bread.
How did they cook it?
I don't know.
Wow.
Listen.
Okay, one more fact.
Okay, so I was looking at everyone's, or probably the most common sandwich chain in the world. Which
Subway?
Subway.
Huh.
The Italian BMT, which is Subway's most popular sandwich, is named for the Brooklyn Manhattan Transit, BMT, which is literally a Subway.
I don't get it.
Subway sandwich. It's a subway in New York. Like, it's the train.
So it's named for the
Brooklyn-Manhattan train. So that subway is named after a subway.
Oh, wow.
In the show, there's a Marcus. 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 In the show, there's a Marcus.
There you have it. Conclusive evidence that diagonal cut sandwiches are better than horizontal cut sandwiches. And I won't hear anyone say different. If anyone wants to fight me over it, they can come to Ireland. I will not pay for your train fare or your plane fare, but I will feed you a sandwich after we have this argument.
Will you fight them dressed as a sandwich? Could you get a big sandwich costume?
Definitely.
That would be a good Halloween costume.
There's a guy
costume.
Who runs around Temple Bar dressed as a Cornish pasty.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
Anyway, that is the conclusive evidence why sandwiches that are cut diagonally taste better than sandwiches that are cut in any other kind of way.
There you go.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of In the Shower with Taz and Marcus. If you like what you've heard, then good news, we have loads of other questions that we've tackled in another bite-sized informative chunk. They're available online on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. They're short, they're snappy, they're sweet, and you will learn something new if you listen to the episodes.
Knowledge is sexy, don't you want to be sexy? People will be attracted to you when you know stuff that you learned from our podcast.
Wow.
I can't write catchy songs. But I can write songs that maybe...
This is what happens when I allow Marcus rant about sandwiches for 20 minutes.
Okay, so if you have a question that doesn't pertain to sandwiches or anything like that, but it's a question that you've always wondered the answer to that has kept you awake at night, it couldn't be easier to ask us. You can get us on Facebook, just search for In the Shower with Taz and Marcus, or you can get us on social media, Twitter and Instagram, just look up at In the Shower Pod.
Marks and I are on hand to tackle any of the questions that you've always wondered the answer to, so please send them in to either of those, or you can get us on email at intheshowerpodcast@gmail.com.
If you just want to say hi, if you have any questions, if you need some life advice, if...
Well, we're doing Agony Ant now.
If you're just feeling a bit down, if you're feeling good, and also if you want to send us a picture of your pet, we're now receiving about 4 or 5 pictures every like 3 days, which is great. I could have just said about 10 pictures a week, but I just wanted to break
it
down.
We're receiving 2.5 pictures in 3 days, which would...
No, so yeah, so if we can up our pet amount, that would be absolutely brilliant.
In life.
Taz and I, we are not allowed to have pets in the places that we live, so we are having pets vicariously through you.
We love your pets.
Because we're not allowed to love our own. Anyway, a couple of thank yous to wrap up the episode. A big thank you to Alan and Paddy and all the crew in the Headstuff Podcast Network. Thanks, guys.
Next up, thank you so much, Flo Robinson, for our amazing cover art of little cartoon Squishy Marks and I in the shower having a scrub.
Having a little scrub. And a big thank you to Dave Gertzman, the musical genius behind our 2 theme songs. Dave, you are a modern day rock star. You're like Metallica and S Club 7 mashed together. It's brilliant.
Wow, I would go and see that group.
Absolutely.
Next up, thank you so much to...
That's all the thank yous. Thank you to you, the listener. No, you know what? Thanks, listener. You're cool and you look great today. Jesus, did you get new jeans? They do wonders for your bum. I tell you, oh my God, you smell really good. You deserve that promotion. You know what? Have this coffee for free because you have beautiful eyes.
Wow. Wink. Wow, Marcus.
You can't hear, but I'm winking into the microphone.
Ding, ding. Ding, 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 ding. Next week's question. We are at the end of recording 2 episodes and we're very, very hyper.
Next week's question is actually, this is a good one. We're getting back into the slightly more technical aspect of In the Shower with Taz and Marcus. Next week's question asking,
how is glass made?
That question will be available next Monday, just in time for your morning shower. But in the meantime, keep scrubbing.
In the shower with Taz and Marcus, 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 in the shower with Taz and Marcus.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to Rabble Radio, the official voice of Rabble.ca and our weekly audio magazine. I'm your host and the editor of Rabble.ca, Chelsea Nash. Well, the 44th federal election is behind us and things aren't that different. Did we go through that process and learn nothing? Maybe, maybe not. We will see how Parliament plays out upon its return. I expect we won't be hearing the last of one of the biggest issues on the campaign trail, the fact that there was even an election in the first place. It's likely that the Trudeau government will have to re-enter the House of Commons with its hat in its hand, ready to face regular question period verbal lashings from all sides of the opposition about Trudeau's ill-advised decision to send Canadians to the polls. In the meantime, here at Rabble, we're unpacking this election one story at a time. Today on the show, I meet up with Joyce Arthur, the executive director of the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada, who is also a Rabble columnist. You'll hear that conversation in just a moment, after which I will take you through the stories of the week you may have missed. Of course, maybe the election coverage just got too overwhelming and you're taking a break from political news. Or maybe you've been so oversaturated this week with post-election analysis you missed what was going on at Rabble. But not to worry, we've got you covered. All that in a moment. This week, I'm joined by a special guest to talk about why on earth Canadian politicians are still making abortion an election issue. It's like clockwork, really, every federal election. Will it ever be put to bed? How much influence does the deterioration of abortion rights in the United States have on abortion rights here in Canada? And what's next in the fight for increasing access to abortion? Here's my conversation with Joyce Arthur. And just a note to say, in case you're wondering about the banging in the background, that's just some construction noise that was unavoidable. So first of all, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the language we use when we talk about abortion and about those who oppose a person's right to choose what they do with their body. Of course, anti-abortion advocates call themselves pro-life. You have used anti-choice. I saw some discourse recently about labeling the group of people who, you know, are anti-choice as pro-forced birth, which struck me as being sort of new and more forceful, maybe. Can you tell me about a little bit about the importance of language when we talk about this issue?
Sure. It is very important that there is a lot of terms flying around out there. You mentioned the anti-choice movement, which I call them. They call themselves pro-life. And I think that's a very false term. It's something that they co-opted decades ago. So they kind of have the term now, but it's very illegitimate of them to claim that term because they're not pro-life. And I'll just tell a little anecdote if I can. There was a doctor in Vancouver who he's since passed on, but Dr. Garson Romales, he's an abortion provider. And he was shot in 1994 by an anti-choice extremist. And I remember some years later, we were in a meeting with some government folks and pro-choice folks and clinic folks, and he was there. And I used the term without really thinking or accidentally, I used the term pro-life. And he interrupted me and says, "Don't ever use that term. These people tried to kill me." And I really remember that story, and it stuck in my head. And it's true. I mean, you know, they shoot doctors, or at least they used to. And they're not about saving lives of whether it's, you know, babies or women. You mentioned that the pro-forced birth, that's a good term. Another term I've heard that I kind of like is pro-punishment. Ultimately, you can actually be personally anti-abortion or pro-life, if you want to say that, yet still not impose your views onto other people, because that's what the term anti-choice means to me. It means you're not only personally anti-abortion, but you want to change the laws and make sure that no one can have an abortion. And that, I feel, is really wrong. And that's why I call it the anti-choice movement. I have no argument with someone who's personally against abortion, as long as they don't impose their views on others.
Right. Right. That's their business, for sure. During this election campaign, you wrote in an op-ed for Rabble that despite his claim to the contrary, Erin O'Toole was not, in fact, pro-choice, as he was trying to convince many Canadians he was. What do you look for when you are determining whether a politician is pro-choice or anti-choice in making that call?
Sure. I guess it is a bit of a purity test because, I mean, basically, if you're willing to restrict abortion in some way, then how can you be pro-choice? And in the case of Erin O'Toole, despite his claims of being personally pro-choice, his policies overall were even worse than previous Prime Minister Stephen Harper's policies. So, for example, O'Toole would allow private members' bills to be introduced by anti-choice MPs, and he would even allow a free vote, including by his cabinet, which is something that Harper didn't allow. And he was in favor of a conscience clause legislation, which is on the wish list of the anti-choice groups. And even though he did this flip-flop, he did many kinds of flip-flops over the election campaign, which I think really reduces credibility overall and many other issues as well. But basically, he's got this cabal of hard-line anti-choice MPs in his caucus. And as long as they're there, we have to say that, you know, abortion rights can't really be safe, not under an O'Toole government.
This is an issue that seems to come up pretty much every federal election. Do you think that the next however many years until the next election, as you know, it's another minority government, could be another 2 years, could be 18 months, could be possibly maybe 4 years? Is this a conversation that's going to be ongoing in the House of Commons during that time, do you think? Or are we just talking about this at election time?
It is something that always comes up during election time. I'm not sure why. Well, I mean, abortion is an issue that it's kind of a political hot potato, and they like to use it as a wedge issue. Just going back to your previous question for a second, I think another reason why, you know, what makes a politician actually pro-choice is if they're willing to proactively improve access. And we're pretty sure that O'Toole has no intention of doing that. But I think, yes, we're going to see abortion issue raised probably in this parliament. I expect at some point there'll be another private members bill from the conservative backbencher. They're always trying to bring back something, and then we're going to have to go in there and fight it all over again. I mean, frankly, I think that since these private member bills are on like human rights issues, I don't think that's appropriate to bring them up into Parliament at all. We should not be allowing human rights issues to be debated in Parliament. So I think it's quite inappropriate.
So this election, once again, we saw a Conservative leader who, you know, you noted in that op-ed, has voted in the past in favor of anti-choice legislation and courted the social conservative vote during his leadership campaign. And then come time for federal election, tries to move to the center by saying he personally is pro-choice, but still keeping that door open for social conservatives in his party, as you were just talking about. Will we ever see the end of this cycle from that party? When will it be time for them to finally move on from this issue? Or do you think the social conservative vote is still too important for them to forego at this point?
Question. I asked myself that a lot as well, because the Conservative Party is in this strange position where they have this right-wing base that they need to try and appease. They need their votes, yet they can't really get elected. They don't have a chance of getting elected unless they move more towards the center and reassure the majority of Canadians that they're not going to be taking away their rights. So how do they do that balancing act? I think it's kind of impossible. And we saw in this election O'Toole trying to move more towards the center, and I think in a way he was somewhat successful in terms of maybe the public believing him that he was pro-choice or whatever. This is like a softer conservatism, although maybe not convinced because of some of other things that he was saying or backtracking on or whatever. But I was very interested to see that the progress that the People's Party of Canada made in this election in terms of their increase in votes. And I think we're seeing many of the right-wing people who previously have voted for the Conservative Party moving to the People's Party of Canada. And before they were supporting the Christian Heritage Party, which is basically nowhere now. They only ran 25 candidates in the entire election, but the People's Party of Canada is growing, and it's really, really scary, because this is like an extreme right wing, and we don't want to see any growth of that in Canada. If they ever won a seat in Parliament, I would say, you know, let's sound the alarm. But hopefully, if enough votes are siphoned off from the Conservatives and go to the People's Party of Canada, unless the Conservative Party become more and more centrist and more like the Liberals, basically, it's going to be hard for them to win another election.
I mean, lately, I've been thinking a lot about how abortion restrictions and bans are fundamentally grounded in misogyny. And I think you would agree with that statement. You know, it's only really ever about controlling reproductive labor as a means to control women. So before birth control, before abortion became more widely accessible, you know, reproductive labor and care was stripped of its value in Western society and became a way for the patriarchy to keep women doing that unpaid labor in the home. So it's about keeping women in this outdated nuclear family fantasy where women are economically dependent on a male partner and in the home because their role is to reproduce and engage in the labor of care required to raise a family. In that light, the anti-choice lobby comes down to misogyny. So how much of pro-choice advocacy, how much of your work is about dismantling the patriarchy itself? Can we move past this so-called debate over abortion while misogyny still exists?
Well, it's a big question, but I totally agree with you in terms of how the whole anti-choice movement is really based on the like historical oppression of women and patriarchy. And it's about, you know, controlling the reproductive power of women, their childbearing capacity. And I just want to say, like, ARC wants to be very inclusive, and we recognize that transgender people also can get pregnant and also need abortions, and non-binary people.
Of course.
And it's important to include that whole movement in it. But going back to the use of language, I don't want to lose the use of the word women. We can say cis women or whatever, because we have to remember this historical background about how it's about patriarchy and oppression of women. And that's discrimination against women is what's at the heart of it. Mm-hmm. And you know, transgender people, of course, experience their own issues of discrimination too. And there's a lot of overlap. But there's room for all of us here, and we all have to fight back against this discrimination, the patriarchy. And it's not just the patriarchy, it's all kinds of different kinds of oppressions that are overlapping and intersecting, right? How to fight that? Well, it just takes a huge number of people, a broad coalition working on different issues, diversity, and it requires a lot of people working in solidarity together. It's not like something that one group or even one movement can do on its own. So I'm hoping that everyone can come together and defeat this impulse to right-wing authoritarianism, basically.
Right. It's it points to the nature of how intersectional, you know, an issue like access to abortion is, of course. On September 1st, we watched as Texas enacted legislation that effectively bans abortion by bypassing the Constitution and making it so that citizens there can sue anyone involved in the process of a person obtaining an abortion. Just Wednesday, there was news out of Florida that it's taking steps to do the same thing. How do those efforts in the United States influence the conversation about abortion rights in our election? Do you think it made it more of an issue this time around, seeing that happen?
Definitely it did, because we certainly hear about those issues and people get very alarmed and upset and they start worrying about, you know, can this happen in Canada? And in fact, some people will say that this can happen in Canada. And there's a bit of a panic almost. And it reminds me of what happened. It was 2019 when Alabama passed a similar kind of 6-week ban, although not enforced by bounty hunters. And that law in Alabama is still not enforced. It was enjoined by the courts. But there was a lot of panic up here in Canada. And, you know, and I'd like to say, and others have said, like, Canada is very different from the U.S. So our political system, our legal system, our legal right to abortion here is pretty secure. But, you know, after seeing what can happen in the U.S. and in other countries, you know, and seeing the election of Donald Trump in 2016, we have to remember that our rights are never safe. We can never take it for granted. And they can be taken away. We have to keep fighting for them. We have to fight to win them. No one's going to give us our rights. We have to fight to maintain them. And sometimes we have to fight to get them back if we lose them. ARC is here to fight back against any possible incursion on our legal right to abortion in Canada. It's why we've fought really hard against private member bills in the past, even though they don't really have any chance of passing, but it's like the thin edge of the wedge, right? And we don't want to give the anti-choice movement an inch in terms of giving them any victories if we can stop it.
So obviously, you know, there's a lot of debate and discussion about access to abortion at the federal level. And it as we've talked about, it comes up every federal election. But as we know, healthcare is a provincial jurisdiction. So as a pro-choice advocate, where do you think most pro-choice efforts should be directed, or where are the weak points, I guess, in Canada? You know, is it at federal or provincial levels?
Both to some extent, but you raise a good point, because the provinces are responsible for delivering healthcare, and that's often where you need to work on the ground in terms of improving access. And now ARC is a grassroots advocacy group, so we do focus a lot on the federal level, but we've also corresponded and contacted various provincial governments as well to, if they're being, say, harassed, you know, pressured by anti-choice movement to pass a bill or some other measure. And there's many other groups across Canada as well that also work on these access issues at the provincial level, as well as federal, including like the National Abortion Federation, Action Canada for Sexual Health and Rights, and many doctors as well. And a lot of people, I think, working in the medical field are there, kind of working quietly under the radar, just making sure that the care is there, that it's high quality and professional, and improving it and expanding it as much as possible. Mifepristone, the abortion pill, is a good example of that in terms of trying to expand access outside the major cities so that people living in rural areas don't have to travel as far. Like telemedicine, you know, expanded with, you know, actually with the help of the pandemic, ironically, telemedicine abortion is happening now. So those are all really positive steps. And I think, though, there is a lot of there is a lot of work that we could do, the pro-choice movement in general, at working with the provinces and to improve access at the provincial level and make sure that care is there. And not just abortion care, but all sexual and reproductive health care in general. There needs to be a lot less stigma. There needs to be more training of abortion providers at medical schools and, you know, really a whole laundry list of things that could be improved. But we're working on it.
So, I mean, yeah, I guess following up on that, how easy is it for women to have, you know, to have access to abortion in Canada at this moment? And what are the main barriers that you're seeing?
The main barriers are, well, New Brunswick is always a big one. There's been a serious gap there for decades now, where the Clinic 554, which is the only private clinic, actually it's a private doctor's practice, not a clinic per se. But the provincial government refuses to fund it because they have a regulation that says they only need to fund abortions in hospitals. This goes against the Canada Health Act. So the Canada Health Act is a federal law, which the federal government can enforce. And that's the federal government's role in healthcare, is enforcing that Canada Health Act, which provides standards across Canada. So there's some equity and universality that everyone can access the necessary health care. Abortion care, unfortunately, falls far short of that. And so not only in New Brunswick, where people often have to travel, but the prairie provinces, there's access points are often lacking. The northern parts of Canada, in the, each of the territorial governments, there's only one city where abortion access is available, so people have to travel. In some cases, there's funding available for to help with travel, either by the governments or sometimes private abortion funds. But still, I mean, part of it is just because Canada is so big, you know, we're never going to have like perfect access, but certainly it should be a lot better. And again, this is a role that both provincial and federal governments can play in terms of the federal government ensuring that the provinces are adhering to the Canada Health Act and ensuring fair and equitable standards across the country. And I think the federal government could do more there to sort of encourage the provinces. And because, you know, a lot of the provinces today have conservative leaders, premiers, and that can be a bit of a drawback too in terms of them, you know, they're not going to be proactive in improving abortion services unless they're pressured. So it's just a project that we have to keep working on.
Yeah, especially in those provinces with more rural populations, right? Like, you know, you just think Saskatchewan, Alberta, those types of places, New Brunswick. Do you think abortion was more of an issue in this past election campaign than normal?
I don't think so because, well, it was a very short election campaign. Mm-hmm. And I think the Liberals sort of came out of the gate talking about the election or about the abortion issue. And then once Erin O'Toole started spouting off about being pro-choice, the Liberals seemed to quiet down a bit and move on to other things. But I think the 2019 election, the abortion was a bigger issue and in previous elections as well. So I don't know if it was just the shortness of the campaign this time or the fact that Erin O'Toole decided to claim to be pro-choice, but it was a bit less so, I think, than previous elections. But, you know, I don't like to see abortion being an election issue because, you know, it shouldn't be politicized like that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it is an important issue. It needs to be improved. So we want politicians to talk about it in terms of how they're going to improve access.
Yeah, that definitely speaks to like how much the Liberals, for instance, you know, they say, well, we're pro-choice and all the rest of it. But if they're the ones that keep bringing it up and politicizing it, you know, to gain points over the Conservatives, obviously, you know, there's some question marks there around the validity of their claim to be truly sincere, I guess.
Yeah, they have. I mean, they've done some good things, the Liberal government, but they've, in my opinion, they've been slow on some things too, and haven't really fulfilled all their promises. And you know, we hear that from our supporters as well. But they have made some promises this time, and that they put in their policy, their platform. And we hope that with some pressure, those promises will actually come to fruition. So we're fingers crossed, we're going to work on that.
Okay. Which brings me to my next and last question, which is just what are the next steps for improving access to abortion in Canada? What's your focus now? What's ARC's focus now? And what, you know, what do you hope to see out of this new but old same government? You know, what are some of those promises that you're hoping, you know, to work on?
Well, one that we're quite excited about, which we've been asking for years, is to put have Health Canada put abortion information on their national Health Canada website, not just you know, how to access abortion, but also just, you know, to clear up misinformation, explain abortion in from a medical point of view, and that I think would serve a really, really important purpose in refuting all the anti-choice misinformation out there, especially that's coming from these, you know, 150 crisis pregnancy centers across Canada that misinform women and people about abortion. So I think that's really exciting, and that could do a lot to help reduce stigma and get correct information out there. They're also going to be providing $10 million in funding for youth sexual reproductive health care services, which is really exciting. And also they're going to be not allowing any new applications for charitable status from anti-choice groups. So advocacy groups or crisis pregnancy centers, if they apply for a charity status in the future, they won't get it. And there's been a bit of a confusion about that because the anti-choice movement is reporting that they're going to be revoking all the existing anti-choice charities. That's not the case, even though we would actually love that. But ARC has made many complaints over the years about specific anti-choice charities, about, you know, they shouldn't be charities. So we're going to go back and look through those and restart resubmitting complaints and hopefully get some other anti-choice groups, existing charities, revoked. And another big promise that they've made is to, the Liberals have made, is to amend the Canada Health Act to strengthen it, to guarantee basically sexual and reproductive health services, including abortion, to so that provinces, including New Brunswick, but also Ontario, will fund abortion. And New Brunswick gets all the press, but there's a couple of other provinces, including Nova Scotia and Saskatchewan, that if, let's say, a doctor wanted to start a private clinic in one of those provinces, it probably wouldn't be funded under the current provincial policies or regulations. So it'd be important to get that changed so it would benefit all of Canada.
And ARC released a press release just on Thursday, looking at, I guess really kind of tying together pharmacare and access to, sexual reproductive care. Can you tell me a little bit about that and why that's the measure you're going after, days after an election?
Yes, it's basically we're starting out by pressuring the province of British Columbia to cover prescription contraceptive, like universal coverage. And we think this is a provincial thing, but we want it to spread to all provinces. And there's also campaigns in Ontario and Manitoba to do this as well. And I think the Liberals even have a promise to include contraceptive care in the pharmacare plan. We'll see if they can make good on that promise. We'll obviously put pressure on them as well. So we're working with several other groups on that initiative. And so it's a broad-based coalition. So that makes it a lot stronger, I think, and important. And so we'll keep pushing for that. I think, coverage for contraception is not covering contraception is practically like it's discriminatory, because you're denying this essential care, really, for women and some transgender people who need it. So it's so crucial. And I think, contraception is so expensive. And if people can't afford it, it also increases the unwanted pregnancy rate and abortion rate. So having a free contraception for everyone who needs it would reduce unwanted pregnancies, reduce abortion rate. It would just increase, improve the health of Canada's population. Be wonderful.
That was Joyce Arthur, the executive director of the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada. You can read her columns at rabble.ca. Now it's time for In Case You Missed It. This week at Rabble, the anticlimactic results of Monday's election left us wondering what is up with Parliament, what is up with our electoral system, and what is up with the People's Party of Canada gaining nearly 850,000 votes. That's 5% of the vote share, in case you're wondering. Senior political reporter Carl Nirenberg weighed in on Elections Canada's decision to have fewer polls this year, including not running its Vote on Campus program for students staying outside of their riding to attend school. We are lucky in Canada to have an arm's-length independent organization like Elections Canada running our elections, he writes, rather than partisans getting involved as they do in the U.S. However, it was a short snap election, and Elections Canada did have little time to prepare. This led to long lineups at the polls on election night, low voter turnout, and a lack of special ballots actually being delivered to those who requested them. The truth is, writes Nirenberg, that the Trudeau government decided to call an election in the midst of a pandemic, knowing full well that campaigning and voting would be more difficult than in normal times. This, despite the fact that Elections Canada had previously signaled to the government that if an early vote were to happen, they would prefer a somewhat longer campaign to be able to prepare. Justin Trudeau ignored that request and chose the shortest campaign possible under the law, just 36 days. The fact that this is the second minority government in a row, with the results being eerily similar to those in 2019, has once again reopened discussion about electoral reform. Just before Election Day, Trudeau said he would be open to considering a ranked ballot system, but not proportional representation. Ole Hendrickson argues that the low voter turnout for this year's election indicates not all is well with democracy in Canada. We need a thoughtful and detailed study of alternative electoral systems, he writes. Hendrickson speculates that it might also give way, that the electoral reform, that is, might also give way for a progressive environmental agenda at Parliament. On the flip side of the coin, some are concerned that electoral reform like proportional representation system would give more power to far-right fringe parties and allow them into the House of Commons, like the People's Party of Canada. Speaking of the PPC, Shira Lurie, an historian of American politics at St. Mary's University, writes that Canada had better heed the warning bells that ring loudly from across the border. The siege on Capitol Hill on January 6th to contest the 2020 American election should not be pushed aside here in Canada as something that only happens south of the border. Quote, we are starting to feel the tremors of a shifting political climate here at home, one in which lies and conspiracy theories radicalize the discontented and sow distrust in our political institutions and processes. How long before those targeting campaign stops decide instead to terrorize polling places or the House of Commons, she asks. Maxime Bernier did, in fact, allege voter fraud on Twitter early in the campaign, and after the election was restricted by Twitter for 12 hours for putting the emails of journalists who were attempting to cover his campaign on Twitter. He tweeted those emails out, accusing the journalists of writing disgusting smear jobs and telling his supporters to, quote, play dirty. Those are two direct quotes from Bernier. Stay tuned for more of our election coverage, where, of course, we will be diving deep into analysis of what this next parliament will look like and what it all means for you. If you like the show, please consider subscribing wherever you listen to your podcasts. Rate, review, send it to a friend. And you can also follow us on social media at RabbleCA on both Instagram, Twitter, and on Facebook. Got feedback on the show? I'd love to hear from you. Get in touch anytime at editor@rabble.ca. I can't always promise I'll respond, but I do read everything, and I appreciate hearing from our listeners. You can catch more of our election coverage at rabble.ca. Stay engaged and keep listening.
This is Democracy Now!
I don't see where I did anything wrong in this matter, and I am lost for words for what they did to me. It was totally humiliation.
Clifford Owensby says Dayton police violently arrested him last month, even though he's paraplegic and repeatedly told them he could not use his legs to get out of the car during a traffic stop. New police body cam video shows the officers dragging Owensby out of his car, yanking him by his hair as he shouted for help. We'll speak with the president of the Dayton unit of the NAACP, who's denouncing the arrest. Then to Iraq, where populist Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, whose fighters battled U.S. forces during the occupation, won the biggest gains in Sunday's parliamentary election.
I can promise you victory for the nation by removing the corrupt and bringing back the honor of what was lost, as well as a serious dedication to the service of the citizen, their dignity, welfare, and security.
We'll speak with Iraqi journalist Nabil Salah about the elections and life in Iraq, where he says Iraq's streets are littered with the memories of our dead. Then, when President Biden addressed the UN General Assembly last month, he called for unity and diplomacy. But critics say he's stirring up a new Cold War with China.